WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In these days of intense media scrutiny, newspapers are quick to offer apologies and fire reporters who breach the ethics of journalism. But when the business side screws up, newspapers are not always so forthcoming. Case in point, last year a major circulation scandal broke when it became known that a number of prominent newspapers, a growing number, had long been misreporting and in some cases wildly exaggerating their circulation numbers to boost advertising revenue. Faced with a crisis, some papers reported on themselves, but others barely mentioned the scandal.
One of the papers that did opt to cover itself was Newsday. The Long Island newspaper appointed a 5-member team, 4 reporters and an editor, to do an exhaustive study of the paper's business practices. 80 articles and 55,000 words later, they continue to do that work. Newsday's media reporter James Mador is a member of that team. He described how they worked together.
We really used a 2-pronged strategy. One, try to get ahead of the daily developments, particularly the investigations of the newspaper by various federal government agencies. There also are a series of lawsuits. And then the second approach was to dig into what happened here. Each of the reporters developed an expertise in portions of the circulation operation so we could learn about how it was supposed to operate and then figure out how it broke down. And when one of us would get enough information on one particular area of the story, then we would all devote our energy to getting that piece of the story in the paper as thoroughly and as quickly as possible.
When you first tackled the story, did the editor give you any kind of marching orders?
We were most concerned about getting stories in the paper as quickly as possible. Because literally the day after Newsday disclosed that it had inflated its circulation, the district attorney announced an investigation. There were already ongoing internal investigations by Tribune Company, as well as an investigation by the Audit Bureau of Circulations, which is the independent monitor of newspaper and magazine circulation across the country. All of these investigators were trying to talk to the very same people we wanted to talk to. So we were, frankly, most focused on getting to these people as quickly as possible and trying to convince them that we would actually publish the ugly information they were telling us about our employer.
What you discovered was some pretty sleazy behavior on the part of your employer.
We discovered that the circulation department of Newsday was delivering papers to dead people, construction sites, burned out buildings, people who had never ordered the paper and did not want the paper. The initial report on June 17th said that Newsday had inflated its circulation by 40,000 weekday, 60,000 Sunday. Those numbers were revised later upwards to approximately 100,000 copies weekdays and 100,000 copies on Sundays. That's about 15% of Newsday's paid circulation.
Okay, now I've worked for quite a number of news organizations that have been in various ways very aggressive in reporting the malfeasance of others, but the moment they become subjected to the media glare themselves get very squeamish. And suddenly, editors and lawyers and publishers come from nowhere to start peeking over your shoulder as you're preparing your stories. To what extent were people peeking over your shoulder as you covered the Newsday scandal?
Newsday has a tradition. We have the oldest investigations team in the country. And there was a lot of pressure both internally and externally to pursue the story wherever it might lead. I know of no instance where someone told my editors or their bosses, we can't publish this. Newsday and Tribune Company, which is the parent of Newsday, was limited in what it would tell us, in large part because the paper is being sued by a number of different advertisers and now shareholders. We would request information, we would have questions, and oftentimes the responses would come back as prepared statements. Now, I will say that there are people we contacted in the circulation department who didn't want to talk to us. There were people who were vendors or distributors of Newsday who were afraid to talk to us because they didn't know what it would mean for their relationship with Newsday. But frankly, I didn't see any different attitude or approach than with any other business that comes under fire.
Often enough, in the midst of a scandal like this, police or prosecutors or potential litigants will leak information to reporters for a variety of reasons. At any point, did you think that people outside of the newspaper were perhaps being cautious about speaking to you because they thought you might be some sort of mole for the business side?
That was something we ran into numerous times. I'd be a very rich man if I had a dime for every person who told me, "I don't believe you're ever going to put any of this in the paper. They're going to shut you down." Our readers, the community, could not believe what we were publishing about the place we work. I got a number of emails, telephone calls, and letters from people who told me that it reinforced their confidence in the paper to report about the community, whether it be the Catholic Church or county government. If we can't report truthfully about ourselves, why should we expect our readers to believe what we report on others?
So you're the media reporter. Kicking yourself for not having picked up the signs earlier that you were literally sitting on top of a major story?
Yes. I've said to myself, I should have figured this out, because our circulation reports, the six-month reports that we would submit to the Audit Bureau of Circulations, always showed an increase of about the same amount, about 1,000 copies. And I think one of the things that's interesting about covering yourself is that we journalists know very little about the business side of our companies.
All right, James, thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Madore is the media reporter for Newsday. Jim Schutz is a reporter for the Dallas Observer, where the local daily is caught up in a circulation scandal of its own. But according to Schutz, the Dallas Morning News and parent Belo Corporation have in no way embraced the Newsday model of self-examination. Jim, welcome to OTM.
Good to be here.
How did the news of the circulation scandal break in Dallas?
It broke about a year ago, and the Morning News at that time divulged some of it on its own. They characterized it as sort of a technical problem with counting circulation. Several months ago, a shareholder lawsuit against them was amended, and a whole bunch of much more specific and controversial, colorful claims were made. And the news did not divulge that. In fact, they were scooped by a competing newspaper. The Star-Telegram broke that story, and then the news chased it the next day with a story about themselves.
The allegation is that Belo Corporation flat out lied in some of its SEC filings about how the overcounting of circulation took place. Consequently, the issue is not merely misreporting, but actual fraud. Now, in your piece, you said that there has been cursory coverage in the Dallas Morning News. Just how cursory has the coverage been?
Well, the news has covered none of its own circulation problems with its own staff. They've brought a reporter here from the Providence Journal, which is owned by the same company. I think they've brought him here, or he may be doing some of the coverage by phone, and he's covered only the sort of official filings and the outside of the story. There's been none of what Newsday's done that is describing how it actually worked, how do people commit circulation fraud, and why is it important. There's been none of that in the Morning News.
Now, I should say here that we invited Belo to come on and discuss this matter for itself, but the company declined to join us. Let me ask you, has the Dallas Morning News been as averse to covering the details of business scandals when they do not involve the Dallas Morning News?
The news has been especially tough on City Hall in the last year. It has to do with a local proposition they wanted passed. It has to do with a lot of real estate politics. But they brought in the international consultant Booz Allen and pored over the city's books in a way that I think most people would applaud. But they were very, very rigorous in demanding candor of the city. So one can't help seeing a pretty dramatic double standard when they're required instead to look inward.
You know a lot of reporters at the Morning News. Are you hearing any grumbling from your colleagues there about the way the paper has covered itself or not covered itself?
Well, the newspaper is run by sophisticated, experienced news professionals. At my paper, we're the weekly. We like giving them a hot foot because that's sort of our bowl of rice. But we recognize that these are good journalists. They knew, they had to know, that they were setting themselves up to be scooped on their own circulation story. And so what I get from inside the news is that this decision to sit on everything is not being made at the newspaper. I think it's being made above the newspaper at the ownership level, at the corporate level. And there's somebody there who just didn't get that they're simply setting the newspaper up to be embarrassed.
Sure, there's the pain of self-flagellation, as the Times and USA Today and others have experienced. But there must also be some level of pain at working at a major news organization and not reporting the story of your own company. Is there anything you've heard from anyone over on the editorial staff that makes you think that they're embarrassed or anything else?
You know, the morning news just went through massive layoffs. Part of their latest story on circulation fraud involved admitting that their circulation losses are twice what they had admitted a year ago. I think that there is some embarrassment, but there's more anxiety and fear about the long-range well-being of the newspaper. I think you have a lot of people who just are hoping to weather this storm. It's not a situation that offers people very many viable alternatives.
Now, Newsday happens to be in the middle of one of the most competitive newspaper markets in the United States. Dallas, on the other hand, is a one-newspaper town.
Right.
Do you think that has had a bearing on the decision just to clamp down?
Absolutely. I mean, the newspaper here is simply not watched the way newspapers are in that climate in the Northeast. I also have to think that at the newspapers like Newsday that have done these mea culpa coverages, or like the Times with the Jason Blair story, that's really painful internally, I would think. And yet somebody has to bite the bullet and do it anyway. Here, I guess there isn't the pressure or there isn't the courage, but I'm from the daily newspaper business. That's where I worked most of my career, but I can't help looking at them and thinking this is just the slow process by which they all finally sink into the La Brea tar pits, and then the rest of us, then a million flowers may bloom.
All right. Well, Jim, thank you so much.
Sure.
Jim Schutz is a columnist for the Dallas Observer.
Coming up, the New York Times decides to reach out to readers and maybe keep anonymous sources at arm's length.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In November, a committee at the New York Times set out to examine how the Gray Lady could increase its readers' trust. This week, that report was released with recommendations for improving accuracy, reducing the use of anonymous sources, interacting with readers, and responding to critics. Among the specific suggestions, having executive editor Bill Keller and two managing editors write a column to deal with, quote, matters about the newspaper. It also suggests better preparing Times writers for appearances on broadcast media and routing reader emails directly to reporters. We gave Bill Keller just under a week to digest the committee's findings. He says the paper can and should find more effective ways to build its relationship with readers.
I just think the world we live in now, you cannot hunker down and, you know, assume that the mystique of the New York Times will win readers over and be enough to sustain your credibility. People, for better or for worse, feel entitled to talk back to their newspaper, and it's a question of how you regulate it so that it doesn't become all-consuming or doesn't make it sound like you're in a permanent state of mea culpa.
Let's talk about the nature of email itself, because it can present a really distorted picture of actual reader reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you a recent radio example. Weekend Edition Saturday with Scott Simon ran a long music interview that sparked apparently an avalanche of angry email, saying essentially that NPR shouldn't be wasting its time with this tripe. Then the producer involved checked the sales of the record online following the interview. They had spiked. The reviews were fabulous. The fact is that the people who complained didn't like it. The people who were quiet loved it, or a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you track your email, as the report seems to suggest, so closely, you may find yourself trying to fight a public perception that doesn't really exist.
Sure. I didn't read the report as suggesting that we try to treat incoming email as a focus group or a poll and track it as a kind of metric on how we're doing. I think what the report was suggesting, particularly in the email section, was that readers have a way to send something in that writers will see.
What do you think about the critics who have responded to this report by saying it suggests that the New York Times bend over backwards?
Well, maybe not backwards. I think we could probably bend a little bit in the name of explaining ourselves. I don't think that talking to readers should be something we do from a crouch. I think we have a pretty good story to tell. And most of the time, when we explain the lengths that we went to get a story and to verify it and to balance it, I think that enhances our credibility rather than diminishing it.
Well, you've just raised the sourcing issue, which takes up a huge part of this report. Some of the recommendations are quite general, and we've seen them before, having editors push reporters harder to get quotes on the record, have reporters push the sources harder, being more descriptive about who the sources are and why they're speaking anonymously.
My problem, and our problem, I think this is a view that's pretty widely shared in the news business, is, you know, we, and I don't just mean the Times, are too ready to publish the blandest of quotes or sometimes the idlest of gossip and innuendo behind a cover of anonymity. I think it cheapens the currency of source protection. I mean, there are some subjects, including much in the realm of intelligence and national security, and any dissident view from a government official or a corporate executive who wants to keep his job, that just can't be covered unless you're willing to protect the source.
But among the recommendations was the suggestion that perhaps a story should be held until sources could be, quote, tightened. And do you really think that on a regular basis, the paper would be willing to lose a big story to a competitor in order to make an extra round of calls confirming the quotes?
This is something we've been wrestling with fairly deliberately over the last few months. And there have been cases, actually, where we made the judgment that a story could wait because the sourcing wasn't strong enough.
Let's talk about the intensifying debate over off-the-record background briefings. There have been calls among a number of news organizations to boycott them in Washington. But the report says, and here's a quote, "We do not believe, however, that we have much to gain by unilaterally boycotting such sessions or by trying to work in concert with other news organizations." But, Bill, without the New York Times, there can't be a boycott. It's all or nothing, isn't it?
I guess I won't rule out that at some point we would get to that sort of, you know, job action. But because we are so competitive, we're not very good at collective action. It's like herding cats to get a bunch of reporters in Washington to rally around any cause, particularly any cause that requires them to miss an opportunity to learn something. And you do sometimes learn something at that ground briefings.
Sometimes, but as you know, very often they're simply the place where you get the generic quote from the senior administration official that really just serves as window dressing on a story.
That's true. And my view of that is you don't have to quote them. What we have been trying to do, and Phil Taubman, our Washington bureau chief, and a number of other bureau chiefs have begun to push the administration to significantly curtail their autopilot insistence on doing these briefings on the background. They started with a visit to Scott McClellan at the White House, because the assumption was if you could get the White House to do this, that would give you some leverage to then take it to individual departments and begin to push them for more of this. And there has been incremental success.
So you think there actually may be some movement in this area?
Yeah, as I said, incremental movement. A few briefings in recent weeks, you know, it's pushing back against the tide.
Bill, thanks a lot.
Okay, take care.
Bill Keller is the executive editor of the New York Times. The perennial journalistic issue of anonymous sources was in full bloom this week. Wired News, after an examination of 700 stories written by freelancer Michelle DeLeo, retracted two of her stories because it couldn't confirm her anonymously sourced quotes. The Sacramento Bee saw the resignation of columnist Diana Griego Irwin when some of her sources could not be authenticated. Veteran Pentagon reporter Tom Squitieri resigned from USA Today after he was found lifting quotes from other newspapers without proper attribution. Al Newharth is a longtime critic of the use of anonymous sources. When he founded USA Today in 1982, anonymous quotes were banned from its pages. Over time, that policy changed, but Newharth remains true to his belief that journalism can exist without the off-the-record source. Al Newharth, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
You once wrote that most anonymous sources often tell more than they know. Reporters who are allowed to use such sources sometimes write more than they hear. Editors too often let them get away with it. Result? Fiction gets mixed with fact.
Well, I think that's a great quote, particularly since you're quoting me. Now, I would add to that that it's been my experience. I started as a reporter 60 years ago. I think most anonymous sources are cowards. They really don't have the courage to tell you what they know or believe to know if they're going to be held accountable for it. And I just don't think that we can afford to trust or use cowards to disseminate information to the public.
Recently, there have been a number of columnists reprimanded. One was from the Sacramento Bee, Diana Griego Irwin, because they couldn't confirm that some of the people who populated her commentaries actually existed. Is this the mixing fiction with fact that you're worried about? Because she stands by her reporting.
Well, I'm worried about that, but I think it's the job of the editors in charge and the top editor to make sure that what is disseminated to the public is fair and accurate. I think it's unfortunate that there have been at least a half dozen or more reporters who've lost their jobs in recent years, including a very good reporter at USA Today at our newspaper, Jack Kelly, who, if he had had more strict supervision, I think would have grown up to be a very good reporter.
Any journeyman reporter knows not to do what Jack Kelly did, complete fabrications.
Well, that's one of the basic things that reporters are taught, but, you know, the temptation is there, just as the temptation for cowardly sources is there to exaggerate or to peddle information that is not absolutely accurate if they're not held accountable for it.
But surely you know that there are certain stories that cannot be reported without anonymous sources. When you banned them from your paper back in 1982, you basically prevented any USA Today reporter from ever reporting, say, a Watergate.
I think perhaps Watergate might not have developed as it did if the Washington Post had not used anonymous sources. I think that may be the case. I'm not absolutely certain. I think when you press public officials who have some information that they want to get disseminated, if you really press them, they'll generally end up agreeing to be quoted if, in fact, the information they're giving you is correct. I think even in Watergate, a good bit of that might happen. I'll just tell you a brief incident. The first week that we published USA Today in 1982, one of our star reporters, Ann Devroy, now deceased, called us from California with an exclusive story that Maureen Reagan, the daughter of then-President Ronald Reagan, would be named the next day to the Republican National Committee, but she couldn't identify the source. And we told her that it was a really good story, high interest. We'd strip it across the top of page one if she could identify the source, and if she could not, we wouldn't use it. So she went back to the same bar where she and Maureen Reagan had had their drink and talked about it earlier. She called us back in 30 minutes and said, it's okay, Maureen has agreed, and her dad has agreed that it's okay to use her as the source. So,
but Maureen Reagan had an interest in having that story reported.
Of course.
A lot of people say in the Watergate investigation, not to keep harping on that, came from the mid and lower levels of government, where they could suffer grievously if they were proved to be a source.
I think if a lower-level source in the government were to have an exclusive of some wrongdoing and then were fired for it, there'd probably be many others who would hire that person for his or her honesty and integrity if he or she were identified.
All right. Al Newharth, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Good luck.
Al Newharth is the founder of USA Today and the Freedom Forum.
Anybody tuning into Pope coverage last month was treated to a rotating cast of experts speculating in the lead-up to the conclave and analyzing the outcome. One of the most frequently quoted was Father Thomas Rees, based in Rome those few weeks, as the eyes and ears of America. America Magazine, that is. For 7 years, Rees was editor-in-chief of the 96-year-old Jesuit-run weekly, until last week when the magazine announced that he was being replaced. The decision to oust him was actually made in March by the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. That's the office charged with overseeing issues of religious practice, and headed at the time of the firing by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, soon to become Pope Benedict XVI. Under Father Rees, America has examined same-sex marriage, condom use in the age of AIDS, religious pluralism, and the role of gays and women in the church. Journalism very much in keeping with the Jesuit tradition of critical thinking and inquiry. Rees isn't the first Jesuit to be punished for upholding that tradition. As Tom Roberts, editor of the National Catholic Reporter, reminded us, such questioning was especially unwelcome during the papacy of John Paul II.
One of the first things he did as Pope was move against the Superior General of the Jesuits worldwide, and that was Father Pedro Arrupe, and had him removed. It was a bold and almost, I think, unprecedented move. It was deeply disturbing to a lot of the Jesuits. So the Jesuits, for the entire period of John Paul II's papacy, were kind of on the hot seat. And we have to understand that this action against Father Rees was in the making for 5 years. Jesuits in Rome were discussing him and what was going on at America Magazine. And it was in March, sometime that we understand, that the final word came down. It's over. Rees has to go.
Clearly, this is a repressive move by the Vatican. And yet, the Rotary Club does not countenance in its international Rotary publications articles condemning the central precepts of being a Rotary Club member, nor does any organization, including the WNYC in-house newsletter, entertain hostile commentary about the management of WNYC. Doesn't every organization have the right not to air its dirty laundry within its own published material?
Well, boy, you use the word condemn, the equivalent of condemning teachings of the church. I don't think America Magazine ever got even close to that. I think within any community, there is the right to, one, information, and two, discussion of the rules, if you will. You know, I don't think that America Magazine was irresponsible or getting anywhere near being irresponsible about its questions about church teaching. What it was doing was reflecting, first of all, the real lived experience of Catholics and the questions they have about women priests, about ordination, about even people with, you know, gay children.
Theologically, the questions may have been fair game. Organizationally, though, I can see how they're problematic.
Well, they may be problematic, but, you know, is the community large enough to accept this kind of criticism? I think Catholics have to understand that the church is not today as it existed when Jesus walked the earth. It's evolved enormously and changed dramatically over centuries, and I think that that change has not come because people have been silent. It came because of a lot of public questioning. I mean, our history as Catholics is just replete with figures who were condemned in one century and heralded as fathers of the church in the next. I mean, if the proscription against this kind of discussion were to have been in place for a long, long time, then we might still be a community that believed the earth was the center of the universe. We might still be a community that believed that slavery was perfectly justifiable.
Does this suggest that Pope Benedict XVI is going to squelch all sorts of dissent about the church, its teachings, its doctrines, its practices, its secrecy, and so forth?
I don't know what it portends. Most of the publications that are either owned by a religious order or attached to the church, I think, will be extremely cautious in this period. If America Magazine, which is very measured and balanced and treats topics fairly, is the kind of journal that Rome thinks should have a board of censors, as it threatened to do during this process, then I think we're skating very, very close to becoming a fundamentalist sect, where, you know, discussion and debate is so narrowly proscribed that you're acting out of fear rather than out of curiosity and scholarly discovery. And I think that there's something not only un-Catholic about that, but certainly un-Christian. I don't think Christianity is the kind of faith that is built on fear of discovery or fear of curiosity.
In the eyes of the Vatican right now, anyway, Tom, can you be a good Catholic and a good journalist?
I guess that depends on who in the Vatican is looking at you. I think that the Vatican would probably say yes. Its idea of journalism might be a bit different from the American version, that journalism may have often an adversarial role with authority. I think that's where the agreement might break down because, you know, we're always, if you will, agitating for more accountability. We want to know who's making decisions and how decisions are made. We want to know where the money's being spent. And that so far is not something that's available within the church.
Well, Commonweal magazine, published by lay Catholics, certainly had a bee in its bonnet this week. They called Father Reese's dismissal shocking and senseless, and that's just where they got started.
Yes.
National Catholic Reporter, your newspaper, also a lay publication. How will it affect you?
You know, people are glad that there are still one or two of us left who are independent who can accommodate this kind of discussion. I hate to, you know, use this moment to say that it's going to affect us in a good way because it's an awful way to have anything good happen to you. I know I've known Tom Reese for 20 years. He's really a model priest and he's just a very, very good human being. He's done more as an individual to rationally and understandably explain the church to the general culture than I think any individual in this country. And if Tom Reese is the kind of priest that you want to remove from his responsibilities, while we have all this other junk going on in the priesthood, and we have a cardinal in Rome who clearly embarrassed the church publicly, and I'm talking about Cardinal Law, and caused great scandal for his mishandling of the sex abuse crisis, and he's given a place of honor during the interregnum and a very public mass, then something is out of whack.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Tom Roberts is editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Reporter.
Coming up, a newspaper instigates an online sting and everyone's favorite man on the street.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with an update. Last week on the show, Ken Tomlinson, chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, explained how he hoped to correct what he sees as a left-leaning bias in public broadcasting with the creation of PBS shows that tilt right. The Public Broadcasting Act forbids CPB to produce or distribute programs. On Thursday, CPB's Inspector General decided to investigate Tomlinson's alleged actions to influence program content on PBS. Democratic Congressman John Dingell of Michigan and David Obey of Wisconsin requested the probe after a New York Times story earlier this month about the politicization of CPB. Tomlinson issued a statement saying he welcomed the investigation, quote, "I look forward to working with the Inspector General and with the Congress to clear up with finality distortions in press reports and elsewhere about our work to bring more diversity to public broadcasting. There would be no debate on this issue if more programs on PBS reflected the high journalistic standards of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer."
In 2003, the Spokesman Review in Spokane, Washington, received a tip suggesting that Republican legislator Jim West had been involved in a child molestation scandal then breaking in the paper. Later tips charged now Spokane Mayor West with offering gifts and other favors to sex partners he solicited online. A 2-year investigation conducted by reporter Bill Moreland and others culminated this month in a shocking series of stories produced with the help of a computer expert hired by the Spokesman Review to pose as a teenager in an internet chat room. That sting operation has since drawn sharp criticism from editors at papers ranging from the Baltimore Sun to the Indianapolis Star. Amanda Bennett of the Philadelphia Inquirer remarked in Editor and Publisher that, quote, "We are not private investigators, we are journalists. Undercover is a method of the past." Steve Smith is editor of the Spokesman Review. He explained how the paper's initial reporting on the mayor's alleged pedophilia began back in 2003.
The initial aspect of our investigation focused on tips, actually, that came to our lead reporter, Bill Moreland, that Mayor West may have been involved in the sexual abuse of young boys in the late 70s and early 80s. Bill had produced a series of stories in 2003 documenting a previously undisclosed, as it were, sex abuse scandal within the Spokane County Sheriff's Department. That series focused on a deputy named David Hahn, who had killed himself in 1981. Hahn's best friend and co-scout leader was Jim West, also a sheriff's deputy in those years. And as the 2003 story was published, Bill began to receive some tips from sources that suggested he should dig a little bit deeper and he could perhaps find a link between Hahn and West in terms of abuse of young people.
How did you go about reporting that part of the story?
That's a classic shoe leather investigation of which Bill Moreland is a real expert. We had tips, we had no names, we had no dates, we had no documented incidents. We were not going to print these allegations unless we had real people, more than one, on the record, identified and photographed. And it took Bill just short of 2 years to finally find the individuals that we were looking for, and our story that was released last week, that part of the investigation was built around two named accusers, both adult men now, both of them convicted felons, but both of them with compelling stories of abuse as young children.
Well, how did you come to start investigating the mayor's online habits?
Moreland is literally on the street trying to track down individuals who may have been molested by David Hahn and potentially by Mayor West. In the course of that, one of the individuals, a source approached by Moreland, said, hey, I've just talked to this 18-year-old kid. He says he met the mayor online in a chat room and just had sex with him. Took us by surprise, didn't know it was there, and that sent us off on a parallel track to try and discern what was going on online.
And here is where you decided to bring in outside help. It's fairly common for police organizations to pose as minors to lure or at least locate pedophiles on the internet. What brought you to the decision to bring in an outsider to do the same thing for the Spokesman Review?
Here's what we were looking for. We initially had one 18-year-old boy who had been chatting online with an individual, an adult male, who was using the screen name Cobra 82nd. He had chatted with this individual for some period of time, ultimately leading to a meeting, a date, as it were. During the course of driving around after dinner, the adult turned to this young man and said, "Do you know who I am?" And he said, "No, I don't know who you are. I don't recognize you." And the man said, "Well, I'm Mayor Jim West." Ultimately, they had a consensual sex act in the back of the car outside a country club late at night. That was in late fall of 2004. For a couple of months, you know, we attempted to try to develop better information about who Cobra 82nd was. And the question I asked my reporter was, can we be certain that the individual we're dealing with is not somebody posing as the mayor in order to hype their attractiveness to young men, portraying themselves as somebody with power and authority? And until the reporter could stand before me and say, "I know this is Mayor West," without qualification, you know, that's not a story. That's just not a story. We discovered that the only way we were going to get at this story was to go online ourselves.
It's no secret to you that all news organizations in this country, especially in the wake of Jason Blair and Jack Kelly, have in fact been on the defensive about whether readers can believe what they read. And now here is a news organization that is explicitly misrepresenting itself to the target of its investigation. This has consequences. You must have discussed those consequences at some length before deciding to take this course.
I was a member of the American Society of Newspaper Editors Credibility Task Force for several years. I'm as steeped in the credibility issue as maybe any editor in the country. So this issue was not resolved easily in my office, and it was an agonizing decision. It's an interesting twist that as I sit here and discuss this, what I'm arguing in essence is that the credibility of our stories was enhanced by this move, insofar as our readers, the citizens of Spokane, are concerned. Absent this effort to name the mayor as the individual who was online without any question or qualification, what we would have had was a he said, he said. Those kinds of stories caused considerable credibility problems because what we reported was true and accurate. And because the mayor was forced to confess to it all and acknowledge that it was true and accurate, if you're a citizen of Spokane, we're quite credible at the moment. If you're an editor in Philadelphia or Minnesota or North Carolina, you've got some serious questions.
Is it possible that the Spokesman Review has done its civic duty here and that you've done a service to your community, but simultaneously done a disservice to the larger journalistic world by the very act of misrepresenting yourself, the harm ultimately trumping the good?
At the top of the list of services citizens expect from their newspapers is aggressive watchdog reporting of government and public institutions. That's right at the top of the list. And it's an area, frankly, where I think our industry may have been a little gun-shy in recent years for a lot of reasons, some of it having to do with resources and corporatization and all the issues with which you're familiar. And so as I sit here now, and perhaps someone will accuse me of merely rationalizing, I tend to think that what we've done is a good thing. I'm open to the argument, and I'm open to the discussion. I don't for a moment dispute that this is an issue that should be debated within our profession. I wish my colleagues were a little more willing to sit back and discuss these issues before drawing such rigid conclusions that I'm seeing right now.
Well, Steve, I very much appreciate you spending the time with us.
Bob, appreciate it.
Steve Smith is the editor of the Spokesman Review. He spoke to us from the studios of KSFC in Spokane.
There's a certain kind of story that calls for a few words from the man on the street. But for every time reporters call on a local man or area resident, there are a bunch of responses you never hear, such as, please leave me alone, or get lost, or how much will you pay me? But if finding a willing voice is a problem for journalists, Greg Packer has provided the solution for more than a decade. In the last 10 years, he's been quoted at least a dozen times by the New York Post. He's been quoted at least 14 times by the Daily News, most recently just last week. He was quoted in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution 2 weeks ago. And Packer has been quoted or photographed at least 16 times on separate occasions by the Associated Press. But who's counting? Actually, Packer is. Last year, reporter Amy O'Leary went on the rounds with the media's favorite, Vox Populi.
Greg Packer is probably the easiest person I'm ever going to interview.
You know, I always come up with an answer for everything, number one. And I always give everybody, you know, the respect and the time that they need. I make it very easy for them. I make it accessible.
Which on April 15th means waiting outside the post office, just in case anybody wants a quote.
Yeah, well, Tax Day is a media event in itself. I try to get my taxes done early and save it for the last minute and throw it in the mail right here in New York on Tax Day.
Okay, see what he did just there? He slipped in the phrase, right here in New York on Tax Day. You've got the time, the place. It's a totally usable quote. Greg's specialty. He's out there every week. First, he checks the newspapers for concerts, sports games, parades, book signings, anywhere media trucks might be camped out. Then, he requests time off from his job as a highway worker on Long Island and shows up early, scanning the crowd for reporters. He gets quoted more than you might think, but for all this effort, Greg doesn't keep his clips. You see, for him, that's not the point. He wants a media job and what he calls a big money offer.
Doing commercials, maybe a radio show, very similar to WNYC and others for that matter. You know, something other than going up and down highway trucks, putting Sanders on, pumping out floods. You know, that's all fine and good because you have to do something. But there's something out there that's better for me.
All in all, Greg's racked up more than 100 appearances in the media. My favorite Greg Packer quote was something he said to the Daily News in 1998 about a Yankees game on Yom Kippur. Greg told them, "There's no way the Yankees will lose, but if they do, they'll certainly have something to atone for."
Do you go up to them?
Or what?
Or do they come up to you?
I think it's a little bit of both. A little bit of both. You know, it's called a mutual understanding.
In the time I spent with Greg, the only journalist who approached him was me. Greg, however, approached two documentarians, three photographers, and a writer. He seeks them out to give them what they need. And Jeff Zilgit agrees. He's a sports columnist for USA Today, who Greg approached at two different sporting events in the span of 24 hours. Zilgit wound up using Greg in his column, but says it's rare that anyone approaches him to offer a quote. Overwhelmingly, he has to approach strangers.
I have not one bit of problem asking a multi-million-dollar player a question. The part of the job I don't really care for is that man on the street quote, because I just feel like I'm bothering people.
Last summer, things changed for Greg when he showed up in a flurry of articles about the Hillary Clinton book tour. Conservative columnist Ann Coulter noticed and called Greg the entire media's designated man on the street for all articles ever written.
You know, she's never met me. But you see, what Ann Coulter is forgetting is, you know, whatever she's got to say about the media, I don't care. But to drag me into it, I think it's terrible.
Greg is a big fan of Hillary Clinton. She's nice to him, she remembers his name. But Greg's no left-wing stooge. He's for the Iraq War and definitely voting for Bush. Coulter may be wrong about Greg's politics, but she's right that journalists could be doing more. After her column exposed Greg's hobby, he was dealt another blow.
It's gotten to the point where the Associated Press, of all people, has had to issue a memo saying not to talk to me anymore. The memo said that the world is full of all kinds of interesting people.
The world is full of all kinds of interesting people. One of them is Greg Packer of Huntington, New York, who apparently lives to get his name on the AP wire and in other media.
This is Kristen Gasley, the deputy managing editor for National News at Associated Press. She wrote the memo.
I sent out a note to the staff noting that, you know, he had done nothing wrong, but that perhaps we were over-relying on him to provide insights into events.
The memo was the AP's equivalent of a bounced check taped to a convenience store window. Before Gasley sent it out, the wire service had used Greg repeatedly on topics like the millennium, St. Patrick's Day, the war in Iraq, and Christmas.
If there's any sense of journalistic outrage that he's pulling something on the media, he always said what his name was. When we called up these stories, they all say Greg Packer. That's who he is.
Hey, Greg.
Hey, how are you doing?
You're first.
One of the first.
The next time I see Greg, he's sitting on a piece of cardboard outside the Virgin Megastore at Times Square. He and three teenage girls are the only ones camped out overnight. Greg tells me that he's probably slept outside this store 10 times for various concerts and signings. Tonight, it's to see Hanson. Sixteen hours later, the wait's paid off. Greg's at the foot of the stage, 5 feet away from the media pool. When he sees a guy with a video camera, Greg asks him to wait while he unrolls a fresh Hanson poster and poses with it.
What's this for, anyway?
It's a strange image, a video camera zooms in on a middle-aged man holding up a poster showing Zach, Taylor, and Isaac, while all around him, teenage girls are checking their lip gloss and adjusting their belly shirts. Ashley, the documentary filmmaker for Hanson, explains why he was drawn to Greg.
It's the big grin. That's what it is. Yeah. He just looks like a happy guy. Like everybody else is kind of packed in here, and even though they're like a lot of them, you know, are here to see Hanson, they're excited about that. They're not sitting here smiling. They're like, oh, I'm sweaty, I'm hot. He's smiling. He's got a big grin. Grins attract people. That's why I came up. That and the huge poster.
The guy has a point. Out of the teeming masses that swarm New York, over 100 journalists have selected Greg for a soundbite. But clearly, he doesn't represent a random sample. In fact, Greg's ubiquity undercuts the whole reason for remarks from the man on the street.
Maybe journalists should just stop doing man on the street
interviews. No, you can't do that. You need the man on the street quotes. You know, it's like the voice of the common person.
But often, as we heard, the common person doesn't like to give quotes, and reporters can't make them. So let's cut them some slack. Greg may not offer a statistically accurate sample of the common person, but maybe he does represent the ones who like to talk. For On the Media, I'm Amy O'Leary.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Susanna Dillaplane and Nick Gilowitz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support from the media comes from Hofstra University, which this November analyzes Bill Clinton's administration at the 11th of its presidential conferences. More details at hofstra.edu. And the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.